IP Fridays Episode 2.
Hello and welcome to this episode of IP Fridays. Our names are Ken Suzanne and Rolf Clayson, and this is the podcast dedicated to intellectual property. It does not matter where you are from, in-house or private practice, novice or expert. We will help you stay up to date with current topics in the fields of trademarks, patents, design and copyright, discover useful tools, and much more.
The first thing we want to talk about is fee reductions at the USPTO. Ken, can you fill in our listeners on this?
Rolf, there may be some good news for practitioners to report to their clients in the coming months. That's in connection with a proposed rulemaking that the USPTO issued on May 9th of 2014. The USPTO is proposing to reduce certain trademark fees to lower costs and also to promote efficiency for their customers. They're talking about reducing the application filing fee by $50, where the current filing fee is $325 to $275 per class. They're also looking at lowering the Tees Plus option by $50, where that would be lowered from $275 to $225 per class. There also will be some fee reductions for renewals. So that definitely is indeed good news, which may come down the pike if everything goes forward at the USPTO with their rulemaking. One quote I thought was of interest is by the Deputy Undersecretary of Commerce for Intellectual Property and Deputy Director of the USPTO, Michelle K. Lee. Ms. Lee states, "The proposed fee reductions advance the USPTO's core mission of serving the public in the most efficient and cost-effective manner possible." She goes on to say, "Lower fees will lessen the burden for entrepreneurs to obtain the crucial trademark protection they need to grow their businesses, while increased electronic processing improves agency efficiency." Rolf, comments are due to the USPTO by June 23rd, and people can go to online to tmfrnotices@uspto.gov for submitting their electronic comments. We'll put a link to that email on ipfridays.com.
If you want to know more about this, please enter www.ipfridays.com/USPTO fees. USPTO FEES. Next up is an interview with John Welch, author of the TTA blog.
So I'm happy to meet John Welch today at the INTA meeting in Hong Kong. He is the author of the TTAB blog, very famous blog and maybe one of the most popular blogs in the IP world. And thank you very much to be here today.
Thank you for inviting me, Rolf.
Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself?
Okay, I'm glad you invited me today, because I think a couple of months from now you might not be talking to me after the United States knocks Germany out of the World Cup, but that remains to be seen. I'm an attorney who practices law in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I've been practicing law for nigh on four decades, both patent law and trademark law, but in recent years I focused more on trademarks, and about 10 years ago started up the TTAB blog. It's about to reach, as I say, its 10th anniversary, and I try to keep track of the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board, both for my own edification, but also because I like to write about it and I like to blog about it, and that's how it came about.
So, John, why don't you tell us more about the TTAB board? Most of our listeners may not be familiar with the TTAB.
Sure. Let me just preface it by saying, for people who aren't familiar with the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board, it's the body in the federal government in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office that hears appeals from both from examiners' decisions. I shouldn't say both. It hears appeals from examiners' decisions, and it also hears inter partes matters involving oppositions and cancellations. The board only deals with registrability. It has no authority to stop somebody from using a mark, no authority to grant any attorney's fees. So it's strictly administrative procedure that has to do with whether a mark will be registered or not. Now, it nonetheless serves a very important function in American trademark law because, for one thing, the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board is kind of where the rubber hits the road with regard to trademark prosecution and application questions as to what the examining core will require in an application, what the applicant has to do to satisfy the examiner. On the inter-party side, it serves as a very useful tool for parties to kind of protect their marks and stop people from cluttering the register with marks that might be confusingly similar. And it's a relatively low-cost way of staking your claim and trying to resolve the dispute on an administrative level without the hurry and the expense of a federal court litigation. So many trademark trial appeal board proceedings are settled. I would say 99% of them are settled. I've been doing this for, as I say, four decades, and I probably had a dozen cases that have gone all the way to trial, including testimony. Almost always they get off track one way or another. One side will give up or they'll come to a settlement. The thinking is, at least in my thinking, if there's a real problem, there'll be a lawsuit. So these are kind of not the most pressing issues for the parties. It's a way to keep your registration strong and keep the register clean without the expense, as I said, and rapid movement that a lawsuit requires.
That's very amazing. 99% settled. That's something that is never heard in Germany, I guess. Like a body where the body never has to decide.
Well, maybe because in the U.S. litigation is so expensive that the right. parties decide it's not worth it. Particularly if all you're talking about is registrability. Often one can come up with a solution that satisfies both sides by either changing the mark a little bit or changing the goods or services in the application and agreeing not to do this or that. So very often you can come up with a solution. And if the marks are dead ringers, then often the losing side will recognize that and give up. So as maybe in Germany, as I understand it, you don't have the discovery procedures that we have in the U.S.,
right.
which tends to run up the costs and
exactly.
drag these things out. Whereas if you were in the U.S., if you were able to get a quick decision, then probably a lot more cases would go to decision. But having done this for many years, I can tell you that there's various ways to delay these things, run up costs from the other side, and kind of force it into a settlement mode if you want to do that.
Right. So what is the actual work that the members of the board of the TTAB are doing? Are they working?
Probably well,
they do. But
I guess they do. I think they do. They probably issue, say, 600 or 700 final decisions a year.
Okay.
So they're handling all of those.
All
they
right.
handle many summary judgment motions, maybe a couple hundred of those. They have a staff of interlocutory attorneys. I should say there are 21 judges.
Okay.
They have a staff of interlocutory attorneys who handle the day-to-day motion practice, motions to compel discovery and motions for this or that. When you're practicing before the TTAB, if you want to get more time or a delay, you file a motion for something. You file a motion complaining about the other side's discovery request, blah, blah, blah. So you can usually keep these things boiling for 4, 5, 6 years before they ever get decided.
Wow.
Of the 700 decisions that the board issues per year, some are pretty long. I mean, you can have a decision that's 60 or 70 pages long and is rather detailed, and they have sometimes enormous records to go through with testimony and depositions. And so they have a considerable caseload, even though maybe the number of decisions, say 700 divided by 21, I guess is, I don't know what that is, 30 each, 35 each final
yes.
decisions. But some of them are really voluminous, and they have to pour through the record and then lay out a decision that explains their reasoning so that one can appeal.
So they do have a lot of work to do.
I think they do,
yeah. Yes. Next time, maybe you will tell us more about interesting case laws. So, dear listeners, stay tuned until in 2 weeks when we hear more about the case law in the U.S.
If you want to learn more about John Welch and his blog, please visit www.ipfridays.com/ttab. ipfridays.com/ttab. Next up is Ken Suzanne with an interview about two recent Supreme Court cases in the patent field.
Ralph, I'm here with my colleague, Dr. Brian Dorn, who is of counsel here at Barnes & Thornburg. And I'm talking to Brian today about two important Supreme Court cases. On April 29th of this year, the United States Supreme Court issued two decisions on patent cases. Brian, what was the issue and how are these cases related?
Well, the two cases were the Highmark and the Octane Fitness cases, and they dealt with the same issue. And they were both the issue of awarding attorney fees to the prevailing parties, i.e. fee shifting. In the U.S., typically each side pays their own attorney fees, win or lose. However, under 35 U.S.C. Section 285, fees can be awarded to the prevailing party in exceptional cases, such as material inappropriate conduct or suits that are objectively baseless or broad in subjective bad faith.
Mm-hmm. And what were the decisions exactly as issued by the court? Why should listeners take note of these?
Well, typically it's been a pretty high standard to get fees awarded to the prevailing party. And in one of these cases, it was awarded to the prevailing party in district court, and the Federal Circuit overturned that. And then hence now the Supreme Court has overturned that. They have found that exceptional, the meaning of exceptional is simply one that stands out from others with respect to the substantive strength of a party's litigating position.
Mm-hmm.
So they overturned the Federal Circuit's what they deemed as too rigid of a standard. And instead of clear and convincing evidence, they just had to, instead of clear and convincing evidence to establish entitlement of fees, they simply had an evidentiary burden. And so there would be more deference to the district court as more in terms of finding a fact.
And the significance going forward for companies and practitioners, how is this going to change the landscape, let us say?
Well, the real significance of this case, I think, is really in terms of the patent troll litigation,
mm-hmm.
in that the abuse of litigation trolls, instead of maybe the true, you know, patent litigation, but the abusive tactics where companies are just suing multiple defendants and all they're really seeking is a settlement that's less than the cost of litigation. It's basically kind of a shakedown. So because of the cost of defending it, companies were more apt to pay because it's just cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
However, now with this kind of change in standard, it's more likely and more favorable to actually fight these cases. The companies can go and try to fight these cases, which are typically not the strongest of patent claims. And in these cases, it'll be easier to get those fees awarded to them for fighting these cases. And this really strikes the patent trolls in their business model. Because they really had low costs, and it was really hard to attack them because their costs were so low and they weren't producing anything. But this is really attacks their model. And it's also significant because Congress has been trying to remedy the patent troll problem, so to say. And they're trying, obviously, to solve it through legislation. However, it's been difficult to craft legislation that does not impinge on the rights of true inventors, particularly small entities. So hopefully this is a way to remedy the situation without getting into legislation that knee-jerks or takes away rights in other areas.
Brian, it might be good in about 6 months or a year to sort of revisit to see the effect on the trial litigation, to see the impact this case might have.
Yeah, well, hopefully it will really hit at the and stop some of the abusive litigation that's been going on.
Brian, thanks so much for your insight. As always, we look forward to talking to you soon in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode. If you liked what you heard, please show us your love by visiting ipfridays.com/love and tweet a link to this show. We would be so grateful if you would do that. It would help us out to get the word out. Also, please subscribe to our podcast at ipfridays.com or on iTunes or stitcher.com. If you have a question or want to be featured in one of the upcoming episodes, please send us your feedback at ipfridays.com/feedback. Also, please leave us a review on iTunes. You can go to ipfridays.com/iTunes, and it will take you right to the correct page on iTunes. If you want to get mentioned on this podcast or even have comments within the next episode, please leave us your voicemail at ipfridays.com/voicemail. You have been listening to an episode of IP Fridays. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by their respective law firms. None of the content should be considered legal advice. The IP Fridays podcast should not be construed as legal advice or legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The contents of this podcast are intended for general informational purposes only, and you are urged to consult your own lawyer on any specific legal questions. As always, consult a lawyer or patent or trademark attorney. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved.